This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. As graduation season comes to a close for this year, we'll talk about a couple of issues in higher education. We'll talk about why more and more colleges are quietly moving away from their commitment to admitting students without regard for ability to pay. And we'll speak with the leader of one that isn't. We'll also talk about why a major financial gift to USC from music mogul Dr. Dre is causing some controversy. First, though, a newsmaker interview with U.S. Representative Marsha Fudge. She is a Democrat from Ohio, and she's now taken on the additional responsibility of chairing the Congressional Black Caucus, known as the CBC. That group has 44 members, and their votes can be key on critical legislation, including the proposed immigration overhaul. They also represent what has been the most loyal constituency of former CBC member President Barack Obama, but they don't always see eye to eye with him. Now, as some key legislation is moving forward, we thought this would be a good time to check in with CBC Chair Marsha Fudge, and she was kind enough to join us here in our Washington, D.C. studios. Congresswoman, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Would you just briefly describe how you see the caucus's priorities for this session of Congress?
Well, certainly everyone's talking about immigration. It is one of our priorities, as well as jobs, clearly, is a priority with the CBC, and poverty. How do we address the issues of poverty in this country? Those are our three main priorities. Those are things that we work on every single day. But we have many other issues, obviously, that we work on. But those are our main priorities.
I did want to ask about one thing that you didn't mention, which is gun violence. I mean, at the beginning of the year, because of a number of horrific incidents, the Newtown shooting among them, the president made a big push for new gun controls. But that seems to be stalled. It seems that African-Americans are disproportionately affected by gun violence, either as victims or as the people who are targeted in certain law enforcement strategies. And I just wondered if there's something that the CBC can do to jumpstart this discussion.
We have been talking about a culture of violence in this country for a very long time, well before Newtown. We lose people every day. Babies are shot in our neighborhoods every day. And so we've been talking about it for some time. And clearly, gun violence is an issue, but it has been an issue in our communities for a very long time.
Well, that sounds like, though, you're saying that you're stuck.
Well, I don't know that we're stuck. I think that, and I'm just going to be very, very frank with you, if I may. We had hoped that the killing of those babies in Newtown would make a difference. I'm not so sure that it has made the difference that we wanted it to make. At least people are talking about it and thinking about it. This country has already said, poll after poll after poll, they want something done about gun violence in this country. But you have to also understand that we work within a structure that even though our voices are heard, we are 44 of 435. Or if you take the Senate, 535. So even though we raise our voices about the issue on a consistent basis, we still have to go through certain hoops to make something happen.
So let's then move to immigration, which you identified as one of the priorities that you're working on here. The Senate's been working on an immigration bill, and increasingly it seems that African-American members of the Congress are raising objections. What's your chief objection? What are the objections that you've been hearing from members?
Well, there are two objections. One is that we've not been involved at the table in the process, and that is a huge problem. When you consider the fact that there are more than 3 million immigrants in this country who are of African descent, or Caribbean. And so I think it is important for us to be involved in the discussion. Our biggest concern is that they did away with diversity visas, which are the visas that have been historically used to bring people from underserved countries, primarily the continent of Africa and the Caribbean. They just took them out of the bill altogether. And so we inserted ourselves in the discussion to ensure that when they say comprehensive immigration reform, it is comprehensive.
Overall, though, what is the caucus's point of view on this? I mean, I understand your point about diversity visas. I mean, the objection that has been raised by people we've spoken with have pointed out, for example, that the bill includes a number of special provisions for people from certain countries. But what about the overall issue? I mean, the moving philosophically from family reunification to biasing towards certain skills, including those in tech. I mean, there are people increasingly who say that this is exactly the kind of thing that has encouraged this country to underinvest in education in this country. What's the caucus's overall philosophy about what should the country's priority be around immigration?
There are three things that we're fighting for, not just the diversity visas, but certainly we as well are talking about the fact that there has to be family unification. There has to be that as a part of the bill. But more importantly, we are concerned about how we build capacity within this country. When you talk about H-1B visas or the high-skill visas, we know for a fact that in this country, there are African Americans who are already prepared to do this work. We know that HBCUs graduate more people in science, technology, engineering, and math in almost any other collective group of schools. We want our people not only to have these jobs, but to build capacity K through 12 to prepare young people for these jobs. But if you say you're going to have as many as 100,000 high-skilled visas coming to this country every year, then that is saying to my children, you know what, don't even go into that field because there's not going to be a place for you.
So the NAACP, which is the one might argue one of the premier or the premier civil rights organization that traditionally represents the interests of African Americans, say that they are supporting the immigration bill in concept because they see it as a social justice issue. Are you saying that you disagree with them?
No, I'm not saying that at all, because there are other things in there that the NAACP supports. Racial profiling, something that we as a people have been fighting for the longest. If it can get in an immigration bill, yeah, we're happy about that. We are encouraged by the discussions that are going on right now, at least in the Senate bill. We are encouraged that they're going to take into consideration some of the things that we believe are important for not only African and Caribbean immigrants, but for people everywhere.
So as the bill stands right now, are you saying that you are going to support it or not?
I'm not saying either, because I don't know where the bill actually is going to be by the time it comes to a vote. What I'm saying to you now is that I am encouraged by the Senate bill. And if that is the bill that ultimately were to come out, I would be supportive of that bill.
Even though it doesn't include diversity visas.
Well, but it does. They may not be called diversity visas, but there are things in the bill that do allow for people, especially from sub-Saharan Africa, from the Caribbean. It also continues to give us temporary protective status for people from Haiti and other things. So there are a lot of things in the bill that are good. Certainly, we didn't get everything we wanted, but we do understand that just because they're not called diversity visas does not mean that there is not a pathway for people that I've just discussed.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Marsha Fudge. She is the chair of the Congressional Black Caucus. She also represents a district in Ohio as a congresswoman. I'd like to turn now, in the time that we have left, to the CBC's relationships with the White House. As you know, of course, African Americans have been the president's most loyal constituency. And in fact, that there's even data suggesting that African Americans increase their voting numbers and vote now at higher rates than the rest of the population for the first time in history. And a lot of people believe that's in large part to continue to support him and his efforts. And yet, you know, the caucus has been critical of the president on a number of issues. They feel that he hasn't worked hard enough on unemployment issues. And you have also, in his second term, been critical of some of his cabinet picks. You don't feel that it represents the diversity that you would like to see, particularly now that some people have stepped down, like Lisa Jackson at the EPA. So now that Anthony Fox has been selected to lead the Transportation Department, are your concerns addressed?
Let me first just put this in context. We have been critical and disagree with almost every president on some issue. Secondly, I think that there is not any group of people in this country who do not believe that they should be a part of the process. We want a seat at the table just as does everyone else. And we believe we deserve a seat at the table based upon the things you just said. We are voting in higher numbers than we ever have. We are a political power base in this country. We are one of the most loyal groups of people to the Democratic Party, and we believe we should be involved in the process. I am certainly pleased that the president has appointed both Mel Watt and to the cabinet, Mayor Fox. I believe they're both highly qualified. I certainly do hope that they will be confirmed. But we're always going to have issues that are different than what the president wants, whoever the president may be.
Overall, though, one issue that has emerged among a number of commentators is the question of the president's tone when he speaks to African-American audiences. And that's something that members of the caucus have also talked about when he's spoken to them as a group, including at the CBC's annual dinner. A number of commentators have pointed out, most recently after he spoke at Morehouse, a college, a very prestigious historically black college in Atlanta, Martin Luther King Jr. and a number of other luminaries attended, about personal responsibility. And they point out, you know, he doesn't give that speech at places like Barnard, a majority white institution for women. He doesn't go and say, you know what, when you get to the corporate suites, don't cut your own deals. Don't just think about yourself. Don't put a daycare suite next door for yourself and forget about childcare for everybody else. I mean, he doesn't take that tone. Other people say, well, this is family, and family can speak bluntly to family. And they feel that maybe he's saying some things that need to be said. Where are you on that?
Well, first, let me say, I'm just happy that he spoke at a black institution. I think that that was is significant. Now, I didn't hear the speech. I don't know exactly what he said in the speech, but I do think that there are some things that can be said to audiences that are familiar that may not be said to other audiences. And I don't want to say it was good or bad because I don't know what he said. But I do know that he does.
Well, you've been there when he's spoken with the caucus.
Yes, well, he has spoken with the caucus, and there are those who believe that he is saying the right thing, and there are those who do not. I personally, and I'm speaking for myself, not the caucus, I would hope that he would continue to address the need for us to move forward and to not focus as much on things that have in the past really hampered us. But I think the tone is important. I really do think tone is important. And he has, I think, because of his own background, has a need to say to people some of the things he says. And I think that's okay. But I do think tone is important.
What metric will you be using to evaluate his performance this year?
One is if the jobless rate for African Americans comes down, which is currently almost double the rate of unemployment throughout this country, how effective this administration is as it relates to issues that particularly impact poor and minority communities. If we get an immigration bill that does, in fact, mean that all people have the ability to come to this country, as well as where we go as it relates to just the economy in general, I think that those are good barometers of a successful administration.
Marcia Fudge is a member of Congress. She's a Democrat from Ohio. She's currently serving as chair of the Congressional Black Caucus, and she was kind enough to join us here in our Washington, D.C. studios. Madam Chair, we hope you'll come back and see us.
I would love to do it. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, music mogul Dr. Dre donated millions to the University of Southern California, and some people are asking why he didn't direct some of his dollars and cachet toward an historically black college that helps educate the fans who've supported him all these years. We'll talk about that in just a minute. But first, we have another story about money and higher education. Millions of college students depend on loans and grants to get through school. Increasingly, though, universities say that they are too strapped for cash to continue to offer admission to students without regard for their ability to pay. It turns out that fewer than 50 schools around the country say they're still able to admit students without considering their financial needs first. Grinnell College in Iowa is still one of those schools, but it could have gone the other way. In a heated vote earlier this year, the board considered stopping its need-blind admissions policy, but ultimately decided to affirm it. We wanted to talk more about that decision and whatever else is on his mind, so we've called Grinnell's president, Dr. Raynard Kington, and he's in fact a medical doctor as well as the college's president. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure to be here.
And I understand that the students graduated this week. Congratulations on the end of another school year. How was it? What was the highlight for you?
Well, we had a wonderful commencement speaker, Sarah Kay, a 24-year-old well-known poet, and she was great. And we also started a tradition of giving an honorary doctorate to a teacher from kindergarten to 12th grade who had an incredible influence on our students. So both were great elements of the commencement.
Well, it sounds very refreshing. So this whole debate over need-blind admissions, which is what this is called, actually took place over of an 18-month time frame. How did it start that this discussion took place? It actually involved like the entire Grinnell community.
Yes, it did. Well, it began with an analysis of our financial position, and we showed that the average need of our students and the amount of need per student were both increasing at a rapid rate. And so while we were not in crisis by any means, we decided that we would take a pause before we got into trouble to sort of do a deep dive, engage all the various constituencies, the Board of Trustees, students, faculty, alumni, and really think about whether or not we could afford to admit students, continue to admit students without regard to need. And the second part of that is equally important, and that is to actually commit to meeting their financial, 100% of their demonstrated financial need if they got in.
So
it's two parts.
How long has Grinnell been need blind, and how has Grinnell been able to afford to be need blind through this point?
Well, we began in around 1980, and it was when a number of schools in that began around then, largely, initially really as a marketing tool to try to impress upon students who were disadvantaged or had large financial needs that they would be fairly considered and given opportunity at schools like Grinnell. So it began around then, and we've been able to do it largely because, you know, there are three financial streams of schools like Grinnell. One is an endowment, two is tuition revenue, and three is for fundraising. And of the three, we have one that is significant, and that's our endowment. We have one of the largest endowments per students among liberal arts colleges like Grinnell, but for both of the other metrics, how much we get on average from students and in terms of tuition and fees and fundraising, we're almost at the bottom compared to almost any of our peers. So it's that tension that really caused us to ask this question.
As part of the deal, the college raised the loan limit for students from $3,000 to eventually $5,500. That's the maximum that students will have in loans after 4 years. That's still quite low by the standards of a lot of other institutions. And I think that, you know, overall, are you satisfied with how this whole decision came out?
Well, yes. First of all, that's the loan cap per year. Right now, graduates of Grinnell graduate with the lowest average debt of any college in the state of Iowa, public or private, and lower than almost many of our private peers. And so we raised the limit as a part of the response. And I was pleased with the outcome because the board actually gave a sophisticated answer. The board's response was, one, we think we can continue to do this. It reflects our values and a commitment to access and assuring a diverse student population. But there was a caveat, and the caveat was, we're going to come back in 2 years. And even with that commitment to our values, we can't continue just increasing the amount of aid we give every year, and that we have to slow it down. And so we're going to look back in 2 years and see if we've been able to level off our aid, amount of aid we require every year. Right now, we spend more than $40 million a year on aid to our students. You know, one metric of aid is what's called a discount rate. It's sort of how much you essentially give back to students in the form of aid as a percentage of your tuition fee. Our discount rate is around 60 or 61%. So it means for every dollar of tuition fee that we have, we actually discount 60% of it back in the form of aid. Well, there's only one other school that's need blind and meets 100% of need that has a higher discount rate that we've been able to find out, and that's Harvard, which has an endowment of $31 billion.
And as I think the nation's oldest university has a long lead time, right, in getting to a strong financial position. Before we let you go, though, in the time that we have left, I wanted to ask if you would just talk more broadly about the whole question of college, what it costs, and what it's worth. I mean, on the one hand, you know, we now have an economy where a college degree is kind of a baseline credential for most people, particularly for middle class jobs. And yet we also have people questioning whether college is worth it, that the cost of college has increased so exponentially in recent decades, but even compared to the increase in inflation, that some people are even questioning whether it's worth it now. And you've got so wealthy donors suggesting that, you know, that people should consider other avenues. They're offering, you know, fellowships for people to take time off from college or forgo college and use that time to invent something. I just wanted to ask you if you and the trustees in the course of this conversation thought more broadly about why college costs as much as it does, should it cost that, and is there something that can be done more broadly to make college more affordable or sustainable?
Well, that's a great question. Well, first of all, the costs are going up because of the close, heavily person-laden cost of providing care, education, particularly because we have highly educated people who work in small groups at institutions like Grinnell, and that drives a lot of the cost because technology, unlike many other industries, technology really hasn't reduced our costs. But the community that's beginning to question the value of a college education is largely a fringe group, I would argue, because I would argue that the evidence remains extremely compelling, that a college education remains an extraordinary investment. And the fact is, obtaining a college education is the most effective way for individuals to grow and to actually be an engine for economic transition from lower class to middle class and beyond. So for individuals who college remains the engine of social mobility in this country, and that's just the fact. And even in the face of the incredible recession that we've been going through, college-educated individuals still had a substantially lower unemployment rate than those who are not college educated. And that's just the economic return. I think there's also a great return in terms of enriching the lives of students and exposing them to a complicated world. So I would argue that the evidence is still compelling that a college education is a great investment and it is the engine for economic mobility in this society.
Well, Dr. Kington, I hope we'll speak again.
My pleasure.
Dr. Raynard Kington is the president of Grinnell College in Iowa. He was with us from Iowa Public Radio in Des Moines. Dr. Kington, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Moving on to other news in education. Last week, hip-hop mogul Dr. Dre and music producer Jimmy Iovine announced that they would be giving the University of Southern California $70 million to create a degree that will blend business, marketing, product development, design, and liberal arts. Many are applauding this donation, not least at USC, but some are asking, why not give the money to a struggling school? Why not give the money to an historically black college or university, particularly since these institutions likely educated many of the fans who've supported Dr. Dre's career. Walter Kimbrough, president of Dillard University, that's an HBCU in New Orleans, wrote about this in an op-ed for the LA Times, and he's with us now to tell us more about it. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I can imagine that there are a lot of people who would say, it's his money, he can do what he wants with it. So why do you even think you should have anything to say about it? So why do you?
Right. And that's one of the things I pointed out in the piece, that it really is his money. He can do exactly what he wants to do. And even looking at some reasons why he may have made that investment there, linking it to the business. But just that gift was interesting to me on a number of levels. First of all, just the amount of money and the reports about the gift. No one talked about this being a historic gift. Mm-hmm. It is the most money given by an African-American to higher education, $35 million. Mm. Most people think of the $20 million that the Cosbys gave to Spelman College in 1988. USC also got a gift from an alumna, Verna Dotrieb, of $30 million. So this gift from a hip-hop icon that is now the biggest gift in higher education, to me, is just outstanding and is fabulous.
So it's more than Oprah Winfrey. Obviously, Oprah Winfrey is a well-known philanthropist and very committed to education. But you're saying that this is even beyond the gift that Bill Cosby and his wife Camille gave to Spelman. Even right. In inflation-adjusted dollars, it's bigger than the amount that Oprah Winfrey gave. Morehouse College has given Morehouse over the years. Certainly much larger than Sean Diddy Combs gave right. To Howard University, which he attended briefly before he left to launch his career. He gave them $500,000. So it's an historic gift. But even with that, it's still his money. Why do you think it should have gone to an HBCU in particular?
Well, not necessarily. I'm just looking at, if you're looking at his career, we're on the 25th anniversary of the release of the N.W.A. album Straight Outta Compton, with the seminal hit that comes off of that album, F the Police. So you have someone who comes out of a culture that really challenged the establishment, and then the money goes to an institution that's the 21st richest in the nation. You start to ask, you know, is this more perpetuation of privilege? That's the kind of issue that I would raise with it, too. And it's not that it has to be an HBCU. I didn't call to say, oh, you should have given that money to me, because those philanthropic gifts are relational. You have to know the people and have those kinds of relationships. And so I understand that, but we have to start looking at and listening to some of your interview with Chair of the Congressional Black Caucus. If we're going to address the broader issues in our society, we've got to start putting resources to those who have the most need. And this gift does not really benefit those with the most need.
I have to ask a sensitive question, though, which is, we've talked with a number of leaders of historically black colleges and universities, you know, and certainly many of their graduates over the course of time. And one of the issues that a number of people have highlighted is a lack of administrative excellence. There are some people who say that some of these institutions are just not well run and that people would not trust them with a major gift. And I understand that that must be painful to hear, and it may even be a stereotype, but there are those who feel that way and have had experiences to back it up. So I wanted to ask whether you think that that might have been part of the calculation.
I don't think that was a part of the calculation. I mean, I do understand there are situations like that that we can all document. And so I wouldn't say you give that kind of gift to any kind of institution. You give that to an institution that has proven it can do a good job with those resources and be good stewards of those resources. So, I completely understand that. That's not an issue for me that people would ask that kind of question, because I think it is a fair question. And we have to understand the kind of work that we do administratively will impact those kinds of gifts. But I don't think that was an issue in this case. I think it's based on the relationships. Jimmy Iovine had a relationship with USC. His daughter went to USC. So it makes a lot of sense for me that he would give that money to that institution.
Well, he didn't go to USC, but he lived nearby. He grew up nearby in Compton, as, of course, I think most people would know. You make the point that Dr. Dre's wealth was generated by Black hip-hop fans, but fans of all races buy rap music, and presumably African-American students do attend USC, too. Do you think part of the message here is to say that all these institutions belong to everybody now?
Maybe. I don't know if I look at it like that. I mean, if you look at hip-hop as a whole, it really is, the development of Black youth culture that really has become this purchasable good in terms of music. And so everything related to hip-hop is really based on Black youth culture. So the wealth that is generated, not only based on the support of people buying and consuming the product, but it's about the lived experiences of people of color that has become purchasable, a purchasable good. So that's part of it as well for me. But, as I'm saying, the broader issue for me is that how do we start to get those who have that kind of wealth to look to say, how do I get the most return on the investment? And you can get a bigger return at an institution that has more low-income students who don't have the kind of resources to attend college and really change our communities. And so that's the question that I'm really trying to get out there for us to say, how do we, let's look at our philanthropy and target it to really benefit the masses.
Why do you think it is that other successful African-American alumni have not donated as generously to these institutions? Why do you think that is?
I don't think, honestly, I don't think we've done as good enough of a job to cultivate those relationships. As a consultant friend of mine says, philanthropy is a one-on-one sport. So it takes numbers of visits to cultivate those relationships. And so people give to people and not necessarily institutions. And so we have to put the work into doing that. Sometimes it's difficult to have the kind of resources to invest in building the kinds of fundraising teams. I mean, for example, USC has over 400 fundraisers alone. Massive number of people working to do that kind of job.
How many do you have?
Oh, I have about 10.
Okay, including you. Are you part of the team? Presumably you're fundraiser in chief.
Right, you have to do it all. So I can't just be the one to come in and close a big deal. I have to, I'm out with all kind of level gifts.
Before we let you go, what kind of reaction have you gotten to the piece?
Oh, it's a range of people. Some people will say, you get the criticism like he can give his money where he wants to and, Black colleges are underperforming. And so I hear all of those. But then there are a lot of people saying you really just asked a question that a lot of people thought, but you sort of asked it out loud and in public. Like, yeah, really, when people think about it, that doesn't really make a lot of sense. But I understand the motives that were used to make that gift. I just want people to have a broader sense of philanthropy and how gifts like that. I mean, if you think about a gift like that, $35 million, if it goes to Dillard, a place that's still recovering from Hurricane Katrina 8 years ago, I would increase my endowment by 50% right off the bat.
Walter Kimbrough. Thank you, Dr. Kimbrough. Walter Kimbrough is the president of Dillard University. He joined us from New Orleans. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
All right. Anytime. Thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now we will hear from someone whose voice, if you like music, watch TV, even pass by a radio, you have surely heard. His name is Armando Christian Perez, but you probably know him as Pitbull. He's sold 5 million albums. He's had number one hits in more than 15 countries, hence another nickname, Mr. Worldwide. He's worked with top artists like Usher and Jennifer Lopez. Rolling Stone said his global hustle can't be stopped, and the Los Angeles Times called him America's savviest party starter. Now Pitbull is bringing the party to the big screen. He has a role in the new animated feature film Epic. The film opens in theaters tomorrow, and Pitbull joins us now from our bureau in New York. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, Michelle. How you doing? Thank you for that lovely introduction, I would say.
Well, you are welcome. You know,
Appreciate it.
We last talked to you in 2008 when you were part of a project to get out the Latino vote, so we wanted to save some time to talk about that, as well as the other big splash you're making with your music. But we want to start with your role in the new animated feature Epic. We wanted to know what drew you to the project.
When I heard the storyboard, it reminded me of a couple films that I watched earlier when I was younger. And simplicity actually is what brought me to the project. I said, if those two films were as successful as they were when I was younger, this is definitely going to be something, I would say, a knockout of the park, no? And when they showed me who I'd be playing, which is Bufo, a toad, a businessman slash hustler, entrepreneur, everything's business, not personal, I said, yeah, I'm definitely game and would love to be a part of the epic opportunity,
epic.
Right? And when they told me who was involved, that's how I started voicing the animated frog, Beyonce Knowles, Steven Tyler, Colin Farrell. Then it just became a true honor to be a part of the whole epic experience.
The film takes you to a world that's kind of hiding in plain sight. Leaf people who inhabit the forest and keep it in balance between the forces of life and death, if I can put it that way. As you mentioned, you play a tough guy toad named Bufo Toad. Get it straight, Night Frog.
Yeah.
And I want to play a clip from the film. Here you are with Josh Hutcherson. He plays a young, mischievous leaf man warrior, a soldier named Nod. And Colin Farrell plays the leader of the leaf men named Ronan, and here it is.
You know I like you.
Yeah, I like you too, Mr. Bufo.
And yet, you don't do what we agreed. It's called teamwork. Maybe if you understood that, the Leafmen wouldn't have kicked you out.
They did not kick me out. I quit.
I admire your independent spirit, Nod. I miss that. Feed him to something. A snake would be good.
Nah, snakes just swallow you whole. Now, if you put him in a hornet's nest, that's a show.
Ah, look, it's Ronan, defender of the weak, pooper of parties, here to ruin the fun.
I didn't ruin all of it. I let you hit him.
Twice?
Hop along now, little froggy.
Easy, Ronan. It's a big forest out there. Even leaf men gotta sleep.
Was it fun?
Oh, absolutely. It was a lot of fun. Very surprising how it would feel once I seen my voice on the animated figure, you know, on the toad. toad frog, they look alike,
right.
You know, tomato, tomato. But I felt like a little kid again. And it was definitely a different experience, but not difficult due to the fact that I live my life behind a microphone. But Chris Wedge was great at just giving me the lines, telling me exactly what they were looking for. And they picked up the hand gestures, the facial gestures. So when I seen the frog, actually when I first seen the toad, when I first seen the toad Bufo, he was naked. When I came back for the second session, they had dressed him in a suit, and he was the only toad in the forest with a suit on. Loved it.
Well, I was going to ask, because your shows, your performances are known for being really high energy. And cool, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool. But high energy. And I just wondered if it was constraining for you to have to just be behind a mic, and you're not even really interacting with any other people, right? I mean, you're there by yourself, right?
Yeah, that's why I say it was different, but not difficult. And when he was, you know, feeding me the lines, I said each line probably 50 to 100 times. I mean, it was 8 hours worth of sessions as we did. It took about a year to do because it was 4 different sessions at 2 hours apiece. And for me, when the kids seen it and they seen, you know, pooper of parties, they started to make fun of it and make fun of me, my kids. That's why I said, oh boy, this is definitely going to be an epic adventure, an epic ride, and something to learn a whole lot from. I'm going to go from Pitbull to to Bufo the Toad.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Pitbull about some of his latest projects. We were talking about the new animated feature epic, which is in theaters tomorrow. But first, now I want to wheel around and talk about your music. First of all, why are you Pitbull? You seem very nice. I don't see you gnawing on anybody's leg. Or how did you get that nickname?
You know, see, that's the beautiful thing about Pitbulls, that they, I think they're misunderstood, sometimes misrepresented, and fit a stereotype. So as far as myself, yeah, the reason that Pitbull came across is because I feel I have the same mentality as of the dog or the breed, for the simple fact they don't believe in the word lose, and when they do, fight to the death. And with me being in the music business, in the entertainment business, this is something that you constantly have to be on your toes, constantly be reinventing yourself, and constantly coming up with new ideas and finding ways on how to be creative enough so that it's new, cool, sexy to the public. So with that said, that's where Pitbull comes from, the fight. You know, I'm in love with the fight. But at the same time, Pitbulls are illegal in Miami, so it makes me the only Pitbull with papers, the only legal Pitbull.
You know, speaking of, I'm glad you mentioned reinventing yourself because, as you mentioned, you're from Miami, Cuban-American. Mm-hmm. You have roots in rap, but you really expanded beyond that. You call yourself Mr. Worldwide, or other and other people do. Mm-hmm. People know you for your high-energy music. Your latest album is titled Global Warming, and I just want to play one of the tracks. This one is titled Feel This Moment, featuring Christina Aguilera. Here it is. Feel this moment. I see the future, but live for the moment. Makes sense, don't it? And I make dollars, I mean billions. I'm a genius, I mean brilliance. The streets is what schooled them and made them slicker than Slick Rick the Ruler. I've lost a lot and learned a lot, but I'm still undefeated like Shooter. I'm far from cheap, I break down companies with all my peeps. Baby, we can travel the world and I can give you and all you can see. Time is money, only difference is I own it. Like a stopwatch, let's stop time and enjoy this moment, darling. One day while my light is glowing, I'll be here. What are you going for at this stage of your career?
At this stage of my career, is it's all about a global movement, it being a global market, making global music. So I've gotten a chance to tour the world, learn from so many different cultures, different sounds, foods, dances, and I just like to apply that to the music. Global warming, it being that that's exactly what we're doing right now. We are creeping up on the world, little by little, something that people before maybe didn't believe, or they heard about it but didn't understand it. And I think now is when it's coming to full reality. Mm-hmm. And with that said, I'm just looking forward to one way or another touching the world, and hopefully we can make a change one way or another.
On Global Warming, you talk a lot about success and being successful and thinking big and dreaming mm-hmm. big. I just want to play another cut from the album. The title track is Global Warming. I just want to let you know it will be bleeped. Mm-hmm. We will be bleeping this. So here it is. Take this as a warning. Welcome to Global Warming. I'm tired of this rap, because all they do is rap about coke, crack, click, clack. But they never sold coke, crack, or click, clack. That's why I'm laughing to the bank. Private jets. I'm on it. Okay. Who are you mad at?
No, that's not mad at all.
Okay.
That right there, that's called emotion. It's called passion. Mad, I don't think you want to see me mad, because I wouldn't be that passionate. That right there is just my way of saying what I feel is going on in the music business. And I feel that a lot of people that listen to music may be misinformed. And me being in the music business now for about 12 years, I've been able to grow, learn, develop, evolve. And that's what I try to show through my music. I try to show that, look, I came from something. I don't necessarily want to stay there. So that, therefore, that's what music was all about, was the escape. So I want to teach everybody out there the same thing, you know, from something to nothing, motivate them, inspire them. Sometimes in order to inspire, you have to let them know exactly where you're from, so that they know exactly that you know where you're going.
Just to clarify for people who aren't clear on everything in your story, you've disclosed previously that when you were a teenager, you did get involved in the drug trade, and you talked mm-hmm. about music was your way out, your therapy. But do you feel you have to defend your success?
Defend my success? Constantly. You constantly have to defend your success. Because, see, the more successful you become, the more of a target you are. With that said, I think Dr. Dre had one of the best lines I ever heard in an old DVD that I seen documentary on Death Row. He said, as hard as you work for your money, it's four or five people working harder to take it from you. And to me, I promise you, it's not about the money. To me, it's about the journey. This is about creating generations and being able to say that my great-great-grandkids say, my great-great-grandfather started this through music, and which involved into the businesses, that involved into things that created futures, to take full advantage of the opportunities in this country, being freedom and being you can control your own destiny. So that, to me, is protecting my success. So my success is my whole family's success, everything that they fought for in order to enjoy what this country has to offer.
You've been getting attention from all sorts of people. Obviously, in the album Global Warming, you collaborate with all kinds of, you know, amazing people. And as you mentioned, you're part of this cast, this epic cast. even Florida Senator Marco Rubio says you're on his playlist. I think you probably know that. This is when he was talking to BuzzFeed this February. When we spoke with him, he actually mentioned that you were on his playlist, but this is an interview he did with BuzzFeed back in February. Here it is.
He basically collaborates on every song, every other song that I hear on the radio these days. He's been very successful. So I think that's his message that he'll continue to grow on. But it's party music. I mean, that's what it is.
What do you make of that?
I think that's great. I want to say thank you, Marco Rubio. I appreciate it.
Does it bother you if people say that your music is commercial?
Oh, no way, shape, or form. The whole point is to touch as many people as you can to get the message across. It's something that my grandmother used to do with the food when I would eat, let's just say, lechuga, tomate, lettuce, and tomato. I didn't necessarily like it. So what she would do is she put it under the rice and the steak, which I loved. And next thing you know, after a couple bites or a couple of meals, let's say, I was asking for the tomato and the lettuce. Through the music, it's the same philosophy if you apply it, because there is messages in the music. I am telling you things that are really happening. When I'm telling you, catch me in Times Square, picture that with a Kodak. Better yet, take a picture of me in Times Square with a Kodak. Then you catch me in Times Square's New Year's Eve ball with Kodak right behind me performing. These are things that I'm speaking and coming to life. When I say, next step, La Casa Blanca, next step, the White House. Si no hay carro, no vamos balsa. That means if there's no car, we'll get there in a raft. It doesn't matter. And look who's speaking about me, Marco Rubio. And who was I with shaking hands and making sure that everything was good for his campaign in Florida, which was Barack Obama. So one way or another, you see it, the music is the ultimate prime example of law of attraction. And if you really listen to what I'm saying, don't hear it. There's some people that hear it. There's some people that listen. And that's a big difference. That's when people start to categorize. Hmm. But I think what Marco Rubio said, there's nothing wrong with what he said. And I think that what he's doing is really tipping his hat off to me.
Oh, I think he is, too. So I'm glad you mentioned that, because I want to loop back to where we started, which is your work with Voto Latino, which is a group, a nonpartisan group that tries to get more Latinos engaged mm-hmm. in the political process. Now that you're Mr. Worldwide, you've got all kinds of interesting deals going. You've got a mm-hmm. vodka line. You've got, you know, people have seen your work in beer commercials, but it actually goes beyond that. Your entrepreneurial ventures go beyond that. You actually yes. have a lot of other things. You clearly have something you want to say. Have you ever thought about saying in the political arena?
My grandmother always told me there's two things you don't speak about when you're at dinner, which is religion and politics. So with that said, I think I have a stronger reach on the public by not being political. So through music, I can get a message across. And not only through the music, may lead them to the simple fact that they actually respect and believe what I'm trying to tell them, or I would say educate them on. I think even with the music, as it becomes more successful and more of a target, then obviously you're going to see more political things happening. But it's all about what's better, I would say, for the country, the people, and a bigger step, the world. And through music, I always say it, it's a universal language. It touches everybody. It breaks down barriers, walls, cultures, countries, beliefs. And through music, you can really unite people. So that's why to me, music is more powerful than politics.
So what's next for you? What are you doing next that's gotten you excited?
Well, as far as the career, I mean, we'll be on tour. We're going to be coming up now. Actually, I start 23rd. We'll be out there. And with that said, I'll be out there with Kesha, which she's crazy, fun, wild, sexy, and a hard worker also. So can't wait to watch her and learn from her. But other than that, we'll be working the new single with Jennifer Lopez called Live It Up, a new single we have coming out called Out of Nowhere. But the music is what leads into, I say, all the businesses, and the reason that we do deals with marquee brands is to be considered a marquee brand. And that way we become equity owners in things such as, let's say, Avoli. And also the most powerful thing that I'm involved with is education, which I feel is the real revolution. And our first school will be going up in one of my old school neighborhoods, Little Havana, in Miami, and it's called SLAM, which is Sports Leadership and Management. And that is a way of engaging and educating, I would say engaging, entertaining, and educating the kids through things that they really love. So this one being more about sports, it doesn't necessarily mean you have to become an athlete. You can become a therapist, a broadcaster, an attorney. But it keeps them engaged in creating a curriculum that they love to come to school. So that's going to be a lot of fun doing. That will be open this summer. And then we'll also be coming with a jam, which will be just artist and management.
So you're not busy at all?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Thank God, working hard. Thank God.
Well, what would you like to go out on? What song would you like to go out on?
As far as from the album?
Yeah.
Out of Nowhere.
Okay, Out of Nowhere. All right. Pitbull is a recording artist, actor, entrepreneur, and philanthropist. He is featured in the new animated film Epic, which opens in theaters tomorrow, and we caught up with him in New York. Pitbull, thank you so much for speaking with us.
No, Michelle, I really appreciate it. To all the fans out there, I want to say, without y'all, there is no movement, there is no Pitbull. I always say it because it's the truth. Para todos los latinos, pa'lante, pa'arriba, no mires para atrás ni para impulso. And everybody out there, God bless, and thank you. Dale. I live the fast life, going nowhere fast. I see my past life, and politely pass. But I'm already planning on doing it big for my life after death, and live my life after death. Baby, what you think all the training's for? Just to properly prepare you for war. So I keep you on your toes so you can look out for them friends. And that's our program for today. Our director is Arjun Hutchins. The technical director is Neil Tivolt, with audio engineer Zachary Coleman. Our theme music was composed by Underdog Entertainment, with additional arrangements by Ian Honeyman. Our editors are Alicia Montgomery, Anne Hawk, and Ahmad Omar. Our special thanks to NPR's librarians. Our senior producer is Devar Ardalan. Our acting executive producer is Carlene Watson. Remember to tell us more. Go to NPR.org/tellmemore. You can find our podcast there. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter. The handle is @TellMeMoreNPR. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Let's talk more tomorrow. Well, every time one of us ending up in tears.